Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and sometimes about some things just beyond the MCU, like today's episode. It's also a podcast that is hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and the ever-so-talented Robbie Earle.
Wow, what a moniker, Kyle.
Yep, you've earned it. So,
So here's the thing about today's episode. I'm pretty sure that long before we ever talked Marvel, long before I think you ever, or I ever even knew that you liked Marvel movies, we bonded over being Christopher Nolan fans.
Did we?
We did.
That sounds right.
Because I actually remember, you may not remember this, but right before I got married, I'm pretty sure that you and me and Stephen Matthew, maybe Seth Penn, went out on this sort of like bachelor party movie night thing to go see Interstellar at the IMAX in Nashville.
The greatest IMAX in the world, by the way.
Oh, it's fantastic. And I remember us sitting out in the parking lot for like an hour after that movie came out, just talking and rehashing stuff.
I just remember us being so emotional. Like you're wrecked by the end of that movie.
Oh, yeah. A movie that we will probably never have reason to discuss much here, but it is vastly underrated in my opinion.
No doubt.
Anyway, I just love the chance to actually kind of talk about this stuff on the podcast because it hasn't come up obviously much, but I think that this is in a lot of ways sort of the root of the kind of nerdy side of our friendship.
The MCU has stolen my heart currently, so it has won over, but Christopher Nolan, and specifically like this movie, even more than Batman Begins, like is where it kind of begins for me. I didn't know anything about the MCU other than Spider-Man a little bit. And then when the Batman stuff came out, I loved it so much. So I was not cheering for the MCU over the DCU or anything like that. It was just The Dark Knight made me love this kind of movie. So You're not far off.
Yeah, that is interesting because for me, as we've talked about before, grew up reading a lot of Marvel stuff, watching a lot of Marvel stuff, and for whatever reason, pretty much totally missed the DC boat. Like, I know that the 90s Batman animated series is seen as one of the greatest, really, well, animated series of all time, but a lot of people would just say kind of serial shows like that. And I just, for whatever reason, never watched it. And so I didn't really watch the Michael Keaton Batman movies or like any of the other bad ones that followed that. Like I think Batman Begins was in a lot of ways, like obviously I was aware of Batman as a character, right? Like it's pretty pervasive, but I think Batman Begins was a pretty big introduction for me into the whole DC
universe.
See,
you know what's funny? At the time, I don't even know that I could have told you which characters were part of what universe. Seriously. I don't think I would have been able to tell you the Avengers was Marvel. Or that if you had like quizzed me, hey, what universe is Wonder Woman in? I don't know that I would have gotten it right. Seriously, at the time.
No, that's fair. I mean, and I think that's also interesting because I think at some point I was such a diehard Marvel fan, largely because I was a Spider-Man fan, that I think even by the time I was probably in fourth or fifth grade, I had already kind of adopted the rivalry thing that, I mean, Stan Lee had been fostering for decades, trying to sort of indoctrinate the Marvel readers against DC. And so, you know, again, to the credit of this trilogy, I think on some level I was probably even the opposite of you, and that I was predisposed to kind of root against it on some subconscious level.
The thing about this movie is I'm just sitting here almost overwhelmed with all the directions I could take this podcast. There's so many big things I want to talk about that are not just tied into this movie. It could be also tied into our MCU stuff and some other things, and Nolan as a director and Hans Zimmer. And I have so much to talk about.
Oh, man,
I don't know which way to go. So why don't you just start with an intro to this movie, and then I'll think about where I want to go after that.
Okay, perfect. You know, The Dark Knight is a movie that almost needs no introduction, but we'll give it one anyway. This is a film that, I'm being literal here, I've never met someone that disliked it.
That's true.
As much as we love Marvel movies, right? Like, I know people that are like, Marvel movies, whatever. And I understand that. I disagree with it. But I really don't think I've ever come across someone that has problems with this particular film. Like, I know people take issue with Dark Knight Rises and Batman Begins, but I think, you know, again, on rewatching it, it's deserving of that. But before I get into all that, this movie is obviously directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yes!
It's written by Nolan and his brother Jonathan Nolan, which is significant. The story here is by Nolan and David S. Goyer, who also did the story for Batman Begins. But the difference is Jonathan Nolan didn't actually write Batman Begins. He wrote the second two in the trilogy. Whereas in the first one, it was Christopher and David S. Goyer. And I think that's significant because, as we'll kind of talk about, I love Batman Begins personally, but this writing-wise is a pretty massive step up from that movie, I think.
And it's kind of fun for me, with my brother being my best friend. I just think how cool that'd be to have your brother make these movies with you.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I think everything that the brothers have worked on together, those tend to be my favorite Nolan projects, even all the way back to Memento. But the cast here is fantastic. I was also struck watching this how many of them are not American but are putting on American accents, which is kind of funny.
Yes.
You know, we have Christian Bale, Michael Caine, Heath Ledger, Gary Oldman, Maggie Gyllenhaal stepping in for the role that Katie Holmes had filled in the previous film. Aaron Eckhart also, who is just, every time I watch this movie, I wonder why Aaron Eckhart isn't in more movies. Because he does an incredible job with the Harvey Dent character.
In hindsight, I think it had to be him, and we can talk about that more later. But like, the Harvey Dent character has to be strong, like as aggressive as he plays it,
right?
To convince Batman that he would want to like put his hopes in him as the White Knight and like lay down his Batman stuff so that he can. You know, he has to be strong and aggressive enough to do that, but also have to make that two-facedness believable a little bit. So, like, how they foreshadow that with some of the scenes of him getting, like, extra aggressive on the prisoner and stuff like that. Anyways, I think he does a really good job with it. And there were some other people that were obviously auditioned for that role. And some of the other names now, in hindsight, it's kind of funny. Like, they would never have worked when you read them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I want to talk about that because I don't know who else auditioned for it.
Okay, so keep going. Sorry.
Maybe most memorably, in a lot of ways, this movie earned Heath Ledger a posthumous Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, and that's something that we'll talk about, but I think all would agree is certainly well-deserved. That's also a landmark in that I'm pretty sure this would be the first quote-unquote superhero movie to win an Academy Award, maybe even to be nominated for an Academy Award, I would think. I might have to fact check myself there, but we've talked a lot about kind of Black Panther in that role and Into the Spider-Verse and even Joker. But I think it says something that for the longest time, these movies were not seen as anything kind of serious. Like, they were a lot of the times overly campy. Like, you wouldn't even watch like Spider-Man, right? Or X-Men, and ever even imagine that they would be up for anything other than maybe like a special effects kind of award.
The Dark Knight won for best supporting actor, Heath Ledger, and it won for best sound editing. But then it was also nominated for six others besides that. It was for art direction, cinematography, film editing, sound mixing, and visual effects.
So. Wow. Well, there you go. Again, well earned, I think. And in terms of critical reception, I mean, this movie is universally acclaimed, but also in terms of the box office, it made a little over $1 billion, which, again, in 2008, that is a lot, even by then superhero movie standards.
I think it also should be noted on IMDb, they have a top 250 list, which is the IMDb's best 250 movies ever.
Hmm.
And it has The Dark Knight at number 4, the fourth greatest film of any genre of all time.
Wow.
Only behind Shawshank Redemption, The Godfather Part 1 and 2, and then The Dark Knight. So to say universally acclaimed is even an understatement to me.
Right.
A couple other notable things on there, just for fun side topic really quick. Inception comes in at 13 on that list. So another Christopher Nolan movie.
Interesting.
And the highest ranked, Interstellar comes in number 30. So still like not as underrated as we made it sound.
Wow.
And then the highest Marvel movie on the list is actually Avengers Infinity War
at
63. Now, I think this is actually technically compiling all fan scores, which actually says something to me first of all, it says to me that fans love Christopher Nolan movies. Now, critics like Christopher Nolan movies, but I think fans, like Christopher Nolan has like a diehard fan base me. That will like die on any hill, Christopher Nolan. That's why those are so high. And then it's also interesting, I guess, that Infinity War is slightly above Endgame, 63 to 72, if it's fan voted. Anyways, a little off topic.
But that is interesting.
Fourth greatest movie of all time, The Dark Knight. Okay, there's so many things to talk about. I think what I want to do is, can I do a quick Christopher Nolan blurb before we then talk about, we need to talk about the performances, we have to talk about the action, and I really want to talk about where the MCU went from this point and where the DCU went from this point. Okay,
yep.
That's what I want to cover. But before I cover that, can we quick talk about Christopher Nolan? There's a few things that Christopher Nolan does in his movies that I love so much. It just resonates with me to the most extreme degree possible. First of all, he's not anti-CGI, but he uses CGI so sparingly just to enhance his practical effects. But if you ever get really nerdy and want to do some research, look at all of the effort he puts into making these movies feel realistic with practical effects.
Hmm.
Inception, he actually spins the hallway in the famous elevator scene instead of it actually being CGI'd.
Wow,
he
I love that.
He has Batman standing on a skyscraper in Hong Kong instead of CGI-ing the background in this movie.
Huh.
When he flips over the semi-truck, one of the coolest looking things ever, it's just a straight-up semi-truck flipping in the middle of a city. So he is convinced that the less he uses CGI, the more subtly your brain is pulled into the story thinking it's real. So even with like a movie Inception, a movie that's so outrageous and it's in your brain, the whole thing, he makes it feel real by never like tricking you with CGI. That's what he thinks at least. And I appreciate that like crazy. This is a guy who doesn't have an email address or a cell phone.
Right.
Think about that.
Which I love.
He literally says he can answer phones if someone needs to get hold of him, they'll call someone on the crew and he'll take their phone. I'm always a few steps away from a phone. That's what he says. But he doesn't own one. That's just hard to believe because he says he can spend more time thinking and preparing and reading instead of staring at his phone.
Totally.
Which is true, but also takes a crazy amount of dedication. He's also never won Best Picture, which I think is an absolute crime.
Yeah, I mean, I know Dunkirk was up.
It was nominated, but he's never won. And I would contest that he's maybe, and I know you might have a little pushback to this, the best director of like our lifetime. Since 1990, I don't know that there's anyone that's made more consistent films when you go back and actually look at what he's working on.
Right.
And I'm not going to get into that argument. But then I also want to say that his films to me come off like he truly wants to make these, not I want to make money. What story can I do to make money?
Right.
So I think that partially is going to tie into what I'm going to say about the DCU is if it sounds like to me that he wanted to make this Batman trilogy and then be done. Like this was a start and a finish to a story to him. Not, hey, can you, you know, if we pay you another $1 billion, can you extend it into the universe? You know what I'm saying? That was not interest to him. So like, I don't think there's going to be an Inception 2 because Inception told the story he wanted to tell. Same with Interstellar. So I love that every 2 years, Christopher Nolan just tries something totally different. You know what I mean? Well, Memento, Inception, Dark Knight, Interstellar, The Prestige, Dunkirk. He just changes genres because he wants to now spend time in that genre. Lastly, during the entire 3D craze, he never got on board with the 3D stuff, which I love because I hate 3D.
Agreed.
Instead, he always embraced IMAX and 35 millimeter film. Which to me is super cool. It's like the Dave Grohl of music, like going back to tape. And the IMAX cameras, for those of you who don't know, are massive cameras. Like they're physically large and they're hard to move around. That's why a lot of people don't shoot entire films in IMAX. They just shoot like cityscapes because they're loud and they're big and it's hard to have around people. He has done some movies where he's made an effort to use them the whole time. And so, anyways, I could just go on and on. I think he's one of the best directors of our generation. I'm not going to take up this whole podcast about that, but I just feel so much of his genius in this film, The Dark Knight. So now I'll let you talk.
No, I mean, I think just to your point, whether or not he's the greatest director of our generation, I think there's something to be said for, like you said, the consistency, but also how much you can watch a movie and know it's a Nolan movie. Immediately.
And I think in a good way though, not a bad way.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's a stamp he puts on it, but not in a repetitive way or in any way that feels like copy and pasted.
I think sometimes, you know, he expects his audience to be paying attention and educated. I don't mean educated as in like high IQ people. I just mean he expects you to be paying attention so close to every detail in the movie. And so I think when you're not doing that, it can come off like, oh, what's he doing? He's just winging this. Like with Interstellar, it's just like, it's so weird. And there's, you know, what's he even talking about? Or Inception's all out there. I'm confused. Well, I think really he explains it all. He gives good hints. He leaves some things up to the audience, but it's all with the expectation of you paying attention.
Right.
So I think without sounding like a D-bag here, I don't want to sound like a D-bag. Some of his movies go over some people's head. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, and it's not because people aren't smart enough, it's that people aren't necessarily interested in putting in
or invested enough.
Yeah, the kind of attention that he's requiring.
Right, and he doesn't care if you don't. Like, okay, then don't watch it. But he wants you to put in the effort, basically. And I love that. To start talking specifically about this movie, let's also say this is crazy that this film came out in 2008. Do you know what else came out in 2008?
Iron Man.
Iron Man and The Dark Knight in 2008 fundamentally shaped how we view all movies, but specifically action comic book movies going forward. Think about that. Both those movies coming out in that year shifted so much of the landscape. It's crazy.
Well, and it's really interesting because I remember whenever I saw Iron Man that year, I want to say The Dark Knight came out first, but I can't quite remember. But I remember having a discussion with a friend of mine, and the way he put it, he said that Iron Man was the best superhero movie to come out in 2008, but that The Dark Knight was the best movie to come out in 2008. And I remember being like, that doesn't make sense.
Say that
but it does make sense.
It does make so much sense. I'm getting fired up because people will throw out The Dark Knight is still the greatest superhero movie of all time. And I maybe agree with that, but what's hard for me is this movie, because of everything I just said, so much doesn't feel like a superhero movie. There is nothing at all in the movie super about it at all. Other than Batman has a cool vehicle, right?
Right.
So it's really hard for me because like it feels so realistic that it's hard for me to say it's a superhero movie. Does that make sense? But it is one of the greatest, I guess, quote, because it's dealing with comic characters, you know.
But it is interesting because even kind of, and we've talked about this before as it relates to different MCU films, but at least for me, kind of what I go into a superhero film looking to get, like that is not really present in this film, if that makes sense. Like I, you know, like I want the moment of kind of good conquering evil in this very, you know, sort of inspiring.
Oh, it's definitely not in this movie.
It's not that, you know, like, and not to say that every MCU film has that in equal amount, but I just think that it really is, like, what's crazy here is that as outlandish as you might say certain things could be, particularly in the next film, I think this one is, like, largely Christopher Nolan tries to stay pretty much in the realm of reality.
Oh, it's, I mean, everything feels real. There's, I mean, maybe the Skyhook thing is a little over the top, but I buy that it could happen.
Right.
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in here that feels as realistic as possible. But isn't it fascinating that when Iron Man came out and The Dark Knight came out, in a way, both of those movies set the MCU and the DCU off in different trajectories. Think about the tone difference. It's almost like the DC, like, because this, by the way, The Dark Knight is not funny or lighthearted at all, at all. There's almost no goofy lines in it at all.
Right. I mean, there are
there's a few quips, but Iron Man takes a very different tone from the very beginning, right? The very first scene is him joking around in the Hummer, right?
Right.
But it's interesting that almost like Marvel in this exact same year took the Iron Man formula and tried to constantly recreate that vibe, right? More fun, more lighthearted, mix in the heart, but like keep it an accessible tone. Whereas the DC universe, it seems like tried to run back this Dark Knight, like dark formula. Think about like Batman versus Superman.
Right.
To a very unsuccessful degree, in my opinion.
Well, and I think
they were like constantly trying to create the difference in these tones, basically.
Right. Well, and I think it's also interesting that The Dark Knight Rises came out the same year as The Avengers. In that The Dark Knight Rises was sort of the culmination of this trilogy, whereas The Avengers was in a lot of ways really the beginning of like the MCU as we know it, and so kind of where the studios went from there. But, you know,
that's my fundamental problem with DC is that they never had the vision that Kevin Feige had. That's really what it comes down to, because you had this Dark Knight. Now, even if Christopher Nolan or even if Christian Bale wasn't interested in staying around as Batman beyond these three movies,
right?
You actually beat Marvel to the punch with Batman Begins. You could have had the vision to start setting up the Justice League and start preparing for that. Instead, everything they've done to me feels like retroactive, like they're responding to what Marvel did. Oh, Marvel's like been building up to Civil War. We better quick throw out Batman versus Superman, even though we haven't built this up as a thing at all.
Well, and that's a really
Marvel's throwing out the Avengers because they built all the solo movies. Oh, we better quick put out Justice League, get something together. And it just no one had the vision to like foreshadow this thing, even though you had The Dark Knight, one of the greatest movies of all time, right there at your fingertips.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there are a couple interesting things there. One, I think that is a fundamental difference between Marvel and DC going really even back to their inception. Because, and a lot of this is Stan Lee, again, not solely him, but a lot of it certainly, was this idea that the Marvel universe should always be interconnected, that everything should matter, that it's all cumulative, right? And what I mean by that is like, largely up until that point, what you had in the Batman, Superman comics that kind of predated Marvel, it was fairly serial to where it was like, okay, here's a full, complete story, and then you can read the next comic without needing really any background because it's going to be another self-contained thing. And Stan Lee really liked the idea of everything building. And I mean, you certainly see where a Marvel Studios that's kind of inheriting that DNA is going to function similarly, because it really did from the beginning whenever it introduced Samuel L. Jackson. And my argument there is that that's actually fine. Like, I love that about Marvel. I think DC has been successful all on its own, even though they have at this point established more of a cumulative model. They've also been great at doing these kind of single focused stories that may or may not affect anything that comes afterwards. And they don't always have to make a big deal about explaining that to readers, because DC readers sort of know not to expect that you're going to have something like The Dark Knight Returns or Superman, you know, Red Sun, like these books that are, you know, kind of alternate universes that have been really successful, but don't have to do at all with the chronology. And the reason I say that is because I would have almost loved to have seen DC rather than try to do what Marvel's doing, okay, give us this one great Dark Knight trilogy. Okay, now give us like the equivalent of a Superman film, if that's possible. Then now give us the equivalent of like a Wonder Woman film and kind of do some interesting things, even in some ways, kind of what they did with Joker. Like, I don't love that movie, but I kind of liked the concept of a self-contained thing. And of course, it was successful enough that they may, in fact, end up doing a sequel, which I think would be a bad idea. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that that rather than try to steal someone else's model, that they're already doing better. I had a songwriting friend of mine in Nashville say this years ago, where he said the problem with trying to do what someone else is doing is that, like, you're never going to be able to in trying to imitate something, do any better than it already is, no matter how talented you are, because there's always going to be this this urge to try to, like, because you can't make it just what it is. So you have to kind of try to change it up somewhat, but people are still going to draw the same comparisons. It's going to be a fundamentally unsuccessful venture, I think.
And yeah, whenever I sit down to try to write a genre that's not mine, it comes off as like a half attempt, because it's not in my heart. Like, that is not, I'm trying to replicate something else, and you think it's easy, but that's not what I'm passionate about. So it comes off across that way.
And it's so funny, because I think people look at the MCU and we've heard so many times, I mean, I feel like every review of Marvel movies, or at least like 80% of them, will use the word formula or formulaic, whether they're saying that a movie is that or that it's somehow broken away from that. But there's this idea that, oh, the MCU has this template, and we've disagreed with that. But I think that the reason why that really is not true is that you've seen people over and over again, studios have this sense that, like, oh, you know, it's so easy. You just do 1, 2, 3 movies and then combine all the characters and then it works and we have this money machine. And that's just not what happens. You have to have something deeper there, like whether you're talking about kind of an emotionally compelling set of characters or even just this kind of spark that's within Marvel that, again, we've kind of talked about as this almost ephemeral thing. And again, I just am constantly seeing this. It's finally happening a bit less now, because we've seen that in other franchises it just hasn't worked. But there was a craze for a while where everyone's just trying to jump on this train. And again, to come back to the film we're actually talking about here, I think what's so beautiful about The Dark Knight is it's not trying to do anything other than be a great film, like a self-contained, it's within a trilogy, but on its own stands as just a masterpiece.
And I agree with you, that's where DCU could have run with that idea instead of reacting to everything Marvel was doing. It's funny you said that about, you know, if it's not like natural to you, instead of trying to recreate what someone else is doing, do your own thing. They didn't do that. And it's funny because you can even see it in little ways, like in Aquaman. If you watch Aquaman, it's like they have been told, it's like the people at DC were told, hey, your movies are way too serious. You take yourself too serious. Look at Marvel. They don't take themselves that serious.
Right.
So they said, you know what? We need to get some jokes in there. And that's what Aquaman feels like. They like don't know what they're doing. Let's write in a couple dumb jokes to try to make them, try to make it more fun, lighthearted like Marvel. And it just doesn't work, because they're not doing what they could have embraced doing. It's just, it's funny. Everything they're doing is reacting to what Marvel did and then trying to do it. No one had the foresight to see it ahead of time.
Oh, totally. And kind of to your point earlier, I think what's interesting is that that was even a course correction, not so much from what Nolan established, but I think from what Snyder thought Nolan had established. Like, I feel everything Snyder did was sort of like this, like, way oversimplification and almost caricature of the Dark Knight trilogy. And then, like, people don't like the Dark Knight movies because they're dark. That is what DC has yet to understand.
That's what they think. The darker we make it, the better critics will think it is.
And I mean, you know,
like, let's never laugh in the movie.
And I say that, I mean, maybe, I guess it just depends on whether you see Joker. I guess Joker is really a success in that it was nominated for a ton of awards and made a ton of money. Critically, it wasn't a success necessarily, but I mean, but that's really only going to reinforce that that message.
Okay, hold on. We're so far into this podcast, we haven't even talked about The Dark Knight as much. Let's also talk about Joker, which The Dark Knight, for you, for those of you listening now, The Dark Knight beat out Joker in our fan poll of which episode to do. But both Robbie and I wanted to say a quick blurb about Joker, okay? Because I do think it fits into this, Robbie.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like I watched The Joker and I thought, you know what? Joaquin Phoenix's performance is noteworthy. It's amazing and it's so good. And there's a really good take in that movie on like mental health. It's clearly a very different Joker than Ledger's, right, which we're going to talk about in 1 second, I promise. But the movie itself like fails to realize that like I as a viewer watch and go, I get it. He has a tough upbringing. Like it's like, instead of doing it in subtle ways, they just constantly literally beat me over the head with it to the point where the darkness is just oppressive almost. Like it's, and it's forced almost. Like it doesn't need to be in there.
Well,
so I don't know. His performance is good, but there's a ton of that where I feel like there was a lot of missteps along the way. And I don't understand a lot of the critical praise it got other than for his performance.
Right. Which I think really is the root of that, which again, I think is well deserved. However, that movie feels dark for the sake of being dark, which I mean to say, even if you set out to say, okay, we're going to make a dark film, that's fine. But the problem is I just never, I finished that movie and was kind of just unsure what the movie had actually been about, right? Like I think the beauty of something like, say, Breaking Bad, right, is that you have this normal kind of mild mannered guy descent into, whether you want to call it madness, at least like depravity. And I think that is something worth, like a story worth telling. Like you see sort of the clear trajectory. What's weird about the Joker film to me, and even by contrast to The Dark Knight's Joker, is that I don't think that it's really telling much of a story or serving much of a purpose, and that what we see is a guy who's mentally ill, who has grown up in incredibly difficult circumstances, and things just get progressively worse and progressively worse until he starts killing people, and then the movie's over. And it's just, there's not a lot of character growth there. There's not a lot. I mean, it's not like we see him really change. I mean, we see him gain some confidence, but even that is kind of mixed in with the same sort of mental illness we're introduced to at the beginning. I think the kind of weird take on the laughter. And honestly, I feel like in some ways, I don't want to overly moralize here, but I feel like it's an interesting take on mental illness. It also tends in some ways to kind of stigmatize it in my mind, and that it's almost like, okay, watch out because these mentally ill people, like at some point they're going to turn really violent, you know? And I'm like, I don't know that that's necessarily a great takeaway either. And I say all that to say, like, I was paying extra attention to that because, you know, this is the first time that I've seen The Dark Knight since seeing Joaquin Phoenix's performance there. And I think as great as Joaquin Phoenix's take on the Joker was, and I think he's just a brilliant actor in general, I could be wrong here. I don't think that the approach to kind of, you know, quote unquote madness was necessarily very unique there. Am I crazy? Like, he did a really good job with that. I don't want to take away from that at all. But I feel like, you know, he's playing sort of
a... It's a little bit of what you argued way back in the day, I think, about Robert Downey Jr. and Iron Man versus Captain America and Chris Evans, that it's amazing, but it's almost an easier role to play the quippy hero. In a way, Joaquin Phoenix's version of the Joker is almost easier to play. It's not that revolutionary,
right,
to play someone who's like mentally sick. Is that?
No.
But whereas like Ledger's is a little more intelligent, a different spin on it.
Yeah. I mean,
a little more of a mastermind.
I think what I'm getting at is, yeah, it is that. And then I think you can think back, I know you're not a big horror movie guy, but even movies like Shutter Island, for instance, like the kind of like suspenseful, like, you know,
yeah,
you've seen that kind of take on this, like, oh, this makes you really uncomfortable because this kind of laughing, maniacal kind of crazy person. And whether they paint that as a sympathetic figure or a terrifying figure. But I just think I have never I mean, Heath Ledger's performance here, like, what would you even compare that to?
Yeah, okay, hold on. Last thing I'll say is not all of the Joker did I dislike. There is some stuff that is really well done. You can still go see it. I think how it ends, I'm not going to spoil it, not the very end, but the scene on the talk show was really thrilling for me. I was captivated. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Sure.
So there is some good stuff there. But yeah, in general, Robbie and I were not as big of a fans of that movie as a lot of people. So that's our little Joker episode inside The Dark Knight. Now transitioning, you can't talk about The Dark Knight without talking about Heath Ledger here. And I think to follow up on what you just said, I got to be careful saying this, but it may be one of the most memorable performances in the last 25 years. I mean,
Oh, certainly.
It's one of the only movies where I just literally, physically cannot get my eyes off of the Joker when he's on screen.
Yeah.
I can't look at the phone. I can't look at, to the side. I'm captivated by this character and how he's playing it. Every nuance. It's this amazing, like, psychopath, but is still grounded in some things. Like, here's a really deep cut, okay? There's a line when he's first in that back restaurant kitchen with all the mobsters, a fun scene when he makes the pencil disappear. There's a really fun line to me. It's so subtle, but he's talking and he's obviously weird and he's doing all his stuff and he's wearing makeup. And someone says, "We're not going to listen to this freak. He's crazy." And he says, No, I'm not.
Yep.
I'm not crazy. And it's like this subtle, like in his performance, like
the
he's
way
almost
he enunciates
offended.
Like, the
don't
tea
call
there.
Me crazy. I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
There's just so many layers to this character. I can't stop watching it. It's one of the most memorable performances of my entire life.
And part of what, I mean, I think, I don't want to overstate this, but I think it is one of the more memorable performances in American film. Like, I just, again, like, you talk about this movie, and one, everyone loves it, and two, everyone immediately thinks of Heath Ledger, right? I mean, Bale is great. I don't want to take away from that at all, but that's not who you think of when you think of The Dark Knight, really. You know,
right.
It's like,
it almost overshadows how good the other performances are because they're
right.
All amazing and solid, but everybody remembers the Joker in this movie.
Well, and I just love, I love who Nolan makes the Joker into here because it's like, one of the interesting things about Batman has always been that it's ultimately a pretty grounded hero. And I think what's really fun about the Dark Knight trilogy is by removing the Supermans from this world, you can really lean into that. And so what does
yes.
it look like to have a villain that matches that? And I think you could argue
yes.
that the villains that we see in Batman Begins and Dark Knight Rises are arguably still like a little more far out, you know, like I don't think that they're unrealistic, but there's like, I mean, the idea of this, you know, just the Bane character and the whole League of Shadows is a little more fantasy-esque, right?
A little more, but he still chose three of the most grounded villains from the DC universe that he could have.
Scarecrow,
oh, Bane,
for
and
sure.
Joker. You know what I mean?
For
versus
sure.
somebody else.
But I just think what's so fun here is, I mean, Batman comics and DC comics in general, I mean, I think the Batman-Joker dynamic has largely been kind of at the core of the whole thing.
Right.
But here, I love it because he sets up Batman so well in Batman Begins, and then he gives this perfect foil of, like, the Joker is super smart. Like, the reason he's so successful is not because he's crazy. It's because he's always thinking, like, four steps
yes.
ahead. And that's why that one scene with Dent where he talks about schemers and how he doesn't have any schemes is a really interesting
yes.
scene.
And he's a liar in general. He's
right.
not only lying to Dent, he lies about how he got his scars the whole time. Like there's a perfect blend of he's an absolute genius and he's absolute crazy.
Right.
He is a little bit of a schemer as
right.
he's scheming four steps ahead. But yes, in the Joker, the movie, the take on that version of the Joker is much more like an unintelligent Joker.
Right.
This is not at all the case. This is like a perfect foil to Batman because, and again, I want to talk about the best scenes, but I think maybe one of the best scenes in the entire film, which is saying a lot, is that interrogation
yes,
scene with him and Batman.
I was just thinking
of that. It's one of the most famous scenes in film history. But one of the reasons is because his dialogue is so good there, and that's basically what he says. He says, "You have nothing to threaten me with all your power and strength, you can't do anything to me because right. he's just scheming ahead. You know what I'm saying?
It's not totally.
It's not a matter of physical strength.
One of the things that I love is that whether or not this was intentional, because I've read some conflicting things, you might know this, about whether or not had Heath Ledger not passed, whether he would have returned in the final film. As much as obviously it's a tragedy that he's gone, I am grateful in terms of the story that we didn't, like the way that we leave the Joker there, where he's hanging there just cackling because ultimately he didn't really lose, I think is fascinating. And so, I mean, you know, we talked about kind of the end of Infinity War being similar in some ways, but just this idea that like, yes, Batman ends up winning in some smaller ways, but ultimately, particularly in light of what we see happen in The Dark Knight Rises, like the Joker is not, I mean, he pretty much did what he set out to do.
See, that's a fascinating point, because I think if a gun was to Nolan's head, he would say that he probably did have plans for Heath Ledger to be in the third one. I think he would have brought him in some way.
I'm sure it would have been hard to turn down another performance like that.
Exactly. You know? But you may be right that it actually tells the better story that he just disappears and we don't ever know what happens to him. It's interesting because my understanding of the DC universe is that the Joker's kind of always been around, right? Like even when there's other villains, the Joker's in the background being a foil to Batman, correct?
Right.
So I do think it's kind of a fun little spin on that, that he's just out there. Story-wise, again, not that he lost his life. I'm just saying story-wise that he's out there and we don't know what happens to him. And you're right. It is kind of a movie where the Joker wins a lot. And I think that brings up another point. Like, in this standalone trilogy, maybe if you were in a larger DC universe, you couldn't do this stuff. But this standalone trilogy takes the risks like killing Rachel Dawes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if you have a greater picture of like 20 years worth of films, can you do that? Because you may think I need Rachel later on the road. And that's maybe a little bit what Marvel has run into as a hurdle. You know, we've talked about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But because this is a standalone trilogy in that way, like you said, wishing DC would do more of that, it takes some crazy risks, like having the Joker kind of not really lose and having Rachel Dawes shockingly die. And by the way, die because the Joker again tricked Batman.
Yeah.
By giving him the wrong address.
And that's what, like, I was thinking, I mean, this movie is so in kind of classic Nolan fashion, not necessarily twisty, but just constantly, like...
Oh, it's very twisty.
I mean,
you never know where the Joker's schemes is going to end. Right, think about that.
But I feel like it is twisty, but I don't want to minimize it, if that makes sense, because I feel like a lot of movies are twisty and maybe like less subtle. Yeah, and in like less subtle ways. Like I feel like what's interesting here is you just can never quite, it's not all these like, oh, gotcha, see, like this is what's happening moments like you might have in other films, as much as just like you're constantly off balance. Kind of in the same way, again, Zimmer's score in this movie absolutely reflects that.
Oh, we have that to get to, too.
It is the, like, you know how we talk a ton about how much I listen to movie scores. This is one of those scores that I have so much respect for and cannot listen to because it stresses me out.
Yes. Think about the very first scene, which, again, is another one of the most memorable scenes, the bank robbery. But it starts with...
Yeah,
that's the score I'm talking about. It's just like, it's stressful as all get out. You cannot listen to it for enjoyment, but it's so good. And it's created this marriage between Nolan and Zimmer that I'm obsessed with.
Well, and I want to argue, and this is, again, we're saying some controversial things here, I guess, but I listen to a ton of Hans Zimmer stuff. Obviously, he's got some really memorable projects from The Lion King to Gladiator that predate this. I really think Nolan brings out the best in Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I watched the behind the scenes. Okay, for our audience, Robbie and I are obsessed with music. That's why we have to work this in here. But also, I'm obsessed with Christopher Nolan and Hans Zimmer. And so I watched this thing about the making of Interstellar soundtrack, which is one of the greatest soundtracks of the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
And Hans Zimmer always tries to mix in something new. So like in Interstellar, he mixes in an organ. There's a ton of organ. It makes it feel very spacey. In Inception, he mixes in an electric guitar player with the orchestra because it sounds kind of spy-y. And I think here, he's mixing in like these tribal toms, these drums that are just constantly pulsating to add stress, basically. And that was kind of like the horns are not the thing here, like in Inception. It's these drums. And I agree. I watched this behind the scenes of the making of Interstellar, and it starts with Christopher Nolan saying, like, he didn't even tell Hans Zimmer what the movie was going to be about because he didn't want him to think space movie. He first wanted him just to get the emotion right. So all he told him was, it's a father-daughter story.
Wow.
To write the first melody. And Hans Zimmer came up with that melody. And then Christopher Nolan's like, that's perfect. It's going to be in space, blah, blah, blah. And that's when they expand on it. But I do think there's a marriage, there's a partnership there that brings out the best in Hans Zimmer. I agree 100%. Like, unique tactics that he uses like that to get that out of Hans.
Yeah.
Also, to kind of keep this moving, we have to also talk about the action in this movie.
Right.
Because the lack of CGI, the use of practical effects, and Nolan's eye for action scenes, you know, paired with Zimmer's score, gives us some of the coolest fighting, like, tense moments. And again, never feeling unrealistic, but one of the greatest car chase scenes ever with the semi and the missile launcher. And then that ending with the truck being pulled over by Batman, and then it coming to a head with, again, Batman's ultimate conundrum when Joker says, just kill me, run me over. And again, that kind of ties, I'm bouncing around here, but that ties back to the Joker thing. This fundamental, the fundamental core of Joker and Batman that comes to a head that makes this movie so good is that Batman is not that far away from the Joker. And he says that a lot of times. Don't talk like them. You're not one of them.
Right.
You're a freak. And they're going to cast you out when the time is right, you know? And it's a little bit true. Because Batman is a, like, detective rich guy of sorts that dresses up in black and beats people up in the night, right?
Yeah, right.
He's doing it for some kind of, like, revenge / vigilante justice. But he's constantly having to ride the line of, like, okay, I'm not going to kill people. That's how I'm going to stay different from other people, right? From bad guys.
Which we saw.
But there's this line he's riding. And the Joker, all he wants is for him to cross that line. Even if it means that I'll die, the Joker, my mission will be, in his mind, be complete if I can get the Batman to kill me.
Right.
Think about the beauty of how weird that is.
Which, again, is in some ways, I mean,
introduce chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what one of the interesting things here, and it's going to sound like I'm trying to get political, and I'm not, but I think if you read much on this movie, there are a lot of conversations about what kind of politics this movie is embracing, which I think says something, and that anytime you have a great piece of art, people try to co-opt it for whatever their kind of cause is. I always joke, there are some of my favorite authors that people from, like, totally different sides of spectrums will try to, like, choose as their mascots. And this is one of those movies that, like, I don't know if you've read stuff like this, but people always try to talk about the fact that it was released very much, or at least made very much in, like, the late Bush era, right? Where it's, like, a lot of conversation about terrorism. The Joker is referred to as a terrorist a lot. And so then there's this conversation about, well, like, is Batman then sort of representing, like, America and sort of the fight against terror? And
There is some of that in there, like in that introduced chaos scene with Harvey Dent that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You could take that a little political, like it's a little bit of commentary on the media when he says, you know, if I say that a bunch of soldiers are going to blow up, no one freaks out. He's not really wrong on that. We would a little bit freak out.
And
I say one little old mayor is going to get shot tomorrow, then everyone loses their mind.
Yeah.
Because it's not part of the plan.
Man.
Oh, by the way, unbelievable scene.
Oh, so good. Although it always cracks me up that Harvey doesn't recognize him until he takes the mask off.
It's like he thinks it's a normal nurse until he takes the mask off. Then he's like, ah, how's it you? I never get that either.
But I just think it's interesting because there are for sure some political overtones, but I don't think it's a political message one way or the other. I think
Let's not really get into that.
Right. No. I think it's interesting because it's kind of a study almost. Like, even if you were to kind of take that premise as a given, I think what's really interesting is that if Nolan is playing with some of these kind of real world political ideas, he's also dismantling them and kind of turning them on their head. Because what I think is so great about The Dark Knight, again, as I, it sounds like I'm belittling the other films in this trilogy. I love all of the films in this trilogy a ton.
So do I.
But I think that what makes this one stand out is the fact that, like, at the end of this movie, you're like, wait, is it – it's not really that Batman's approach to this, it, like, proved super successful. Like, in some ways, you know, what you see happen to Harvey is kind of Batman and Gordon's fault. Like, I mean, you that's coming from Harvey, who's really injured and like, deranged at that point. But also, it's like he's – when he's kind of giving that speech at the end and some of the speeches that you hear Joker give, you're like, they're not – totally wrong, you know?
No, he's not.
Like,
yes.
Batman's not wrong for trying to do the... Like, he's trying to do the right thing. But I think what I realized on this watch, and not that this is, like, particularly profound, but you know what ultimately kind of ends up being the turning point of the movie is not anything that Batman does, but it's really the decision by the people on those ferries to not give in.
I think it's a little bit what makes a villain good in general. I think it's a little bit of what Killmonger, Hela, and Thanos have.
Right.
Is that you need to have some moments where you say, I'm not necessarily cheering for you, but you're not 100% wrong.
Right, right.
And the movie does hinge a little bit there, like when he says that the people of Gotham showed you that they still believe in good. Basically, they chose good versus evil.
And I love that because ultimately, like, and just kind of to wrap up this side of things, I think what's interesting about the people that talk about this movie being hyper political or hyper philosophical or hyper whatever, one way or the other, and there are all sorts of takes on this. I think
they still choose good.
Yeah, like ultimately, you have the ordinary people there choosing selflessness and choosing good, and I think that's what kind of turns the tide in a lot of ways. Even just, you know, on kind of a symbolic level or whatever. But I love that, and that's also one of the most memorable scenes of the movie for me. And I think that's, again, you know, that's the moment that kind of gives Batman hope, I guess, that he's not just fighting this totally pointless battle. And even that line, like, what, did you just want to prove that deep down everyone's as ugly as you are?
Yes.
Which yes. By the side note, is kind of what Joker is like about. Like, the film is almost saying that deep down everyone is as ugly as the Joker is.
That's
so I think
true.
It's interesting, the dichotomy there as well.
Well, I think that's the fundamental difference, right? Is that Batman thinks deep down the average person does have some good, whereas Joker thinks they can all be corrupted. Everybody, even Batman, can be corrupted. So by Batman not killing him and by the people choosing good, that's kind of how Batman wins. But yes, it's kind of riding that line the whole time. There's a ton of gray area because it's not necessarily winning via his normal tactics or Gordon's normal decisions.
Well,
we make a lot of mistakes.
Well, and especially the, like, again, going back to that interrogation scene, it's this idea that Batman can't throw enough money at this or throw enough, like, great martial arts skills at it. Like, he can't, like, brute force his way to a victory in this movie.
And then there's, you know, we love gray area on this podcast, but there's another gray area here where it's like, you kind of wonder how many lives would have been spared if Batman was willing to just kill Joker.
Right.
What if right then and there he just murdered him? Now, that's his one rule he won't break. But think about how many more people would have had a lot easier of a time. How much life could have been saved. So that's what's funny about the gray area with his one rule, you know?
Right.
Even in the party scene, which is incredible, Batman is seen dismantling guns. Whereas it's like, well, you might want to help use them right now in this exact setting because of what's happening to people.
Right, right.
But I love that gray area. That's my point, though. I love the gray area. So it's like, Joker's not totally wrong that Batman's not that far from him.
Right. No, I mean, but it is funny because, I mean, we had that scene in Batman Begins that kind of highlighted the character's refusal to give in to, you know, that particular temptation. Like, and it's almost the sense that he knows. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's like, that is kind of the one thing that I think kind of tethers him. And to the degree that, like, there is a level of insanity to doing what it is that Bruce Wayne does, like, I feel like, if that rule were broken, you could imagine there also being kind of a break within him of even like his identity and kind of what he stands for. And how far at that point is he from someone like the Joker, even if he starts out with the best of intentions?
But would it have been the right decision just to kill him? It might have been. It might have been easier. I don't know.
I mean, Tony killed really Thanos. Exactly.
To keep it moving here real quick. Another thing we have to talk about briefly is one thing the MCU has always done really well, and Christopher Nolan does really well, is amidst all the hype and the action and all of that, is they get the heart right. The heart of the movie and the emotions between human interactions and characters. And that's one thing the DC universe in general, I think, gets very wrong, is I don't feel those movies as much as, even in a movie like Guardians 2 that I don't really like, I end up feeling Yondu's death, you know? And it's really well done here. Now, I'll make an argument that Christopher Nolan actually gets better at this part of it as he goes along. Like, the heart driving Inception and Interstellar are like his masterpieces to me. That you feel Mal jumping off the hotel room, and you feel a dad missing his daughter in space, like missing his entire life with her.
Oh yeah. Right? Interstellar is certainly the peak of that for me.
Right. And it really bothers you. It's really well done here, but I just wanted to add that I think he gets better. But even to have this movie be grounded between Batman's insecurity of if he's good enough in his dialogue with Alfred, right? Or how much they care for Alfred or how much he cares for Rachel. It still has a lot of heart in this movie. And that's one thing the DC universe doesn't do very well.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's been a lot of flack, and I think rightfully so, that to the extent Superman is kind of supposed to be the Captain America type figure of DC, that in all of the Snyder films, and I don't blame this on Henry Cavill, who I think does a pretty good job as much as the direction and the writing, but he is like the grimmest, like just most intense, dour superhero in the world. And Superman is supposed to be like one of the most like kind of triumphant and fun and good superheroes. So yeah, I mean, you're right. You're right in that regard, I think.
And kind of to tie a few of those things together, one of the coolest scenes to me too, talking about the chaos of the Joker and if the Batman's going to cross that line or break those rules, and then tying together the grimness of the later movies, one of the coolest parts for me is when Batman is so insecure about if he can't do it and if he should give up and lay down and give in to a terrorist's whims. Mm-hmm. When he talks to Alfred and he says, how did you end up catching that villain in that story he was talking about? And he says, we burned the entire forest down. And again, it's this gray area of how far are you willing to go to stop this one guy?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, how much bad does a character like Batman have to do for ultimate good, and what's worth it or not?
Yeah.
And I love it kind of like hinging on that.
And again, I mean, it is a really interesting take to the degree that the movie was a commentary on terrorism, because there is just this idea that it's like you feel so helpless when it's like you're fighting someone that is just pure evil and their only goal is to just cause pain. And like they don't want anything out of it. So you have zero leverage. Like, and I think that's
it's easier when it's someone just trying to take over a land or something. Then you can make an enemy out of it, know what to do. Yeah. This is like Joker doesn't have anything.
Right.
He just wants to cause pain. Like you said, chaos.
Like at least Thanos has a particular goal, right? That they can keep from happening or whatever. Yeah. But I think that's so unique here. Also just, to your point in our podcast a long time ago, I think that there are a lot of differences between this movie and any MCU film, obviously. But I do think you're right in that the Winter Soldier maybe would not have been made if not for the Dark Knight. Like, I think that a lot of what I think is best about the Winter Soldier in terms of kind of the gray areas, like we said, some of the complexities there, but particularly the action scenes and the kind of the choreography style that we see the Russo brothers go after there, I feel like there is a lot, they're indebted to the Dark Knight in a pretty significant way.
Yeah. I think that's one reason I like the Russo brothers so much, is it feels like Christopher Nolan and the Russo brothers are kind of from the same tree in how they make movies a little bit and how they think about it. I think about the elevator scene in Winter Soldier being such a famous action scene and right. how much care was given to that with practical effects and actual learning the combat from the character. Right. And that feels very Nolan-esque to me and how he approaches it.
And I do love the way that Nolan does rely more on practical stuff here, like you said. And that's another area where I just think you can immediately, like, Marvel obviously has to rely on that as they get more and more kind of sci-fi-y through the MCU. And I don't begrudge them that. But I do really love how, like, the Dark Knight is never going to have any trouble holding up as it ages, right? Like, there's not going to be any CGI issues, right?
Yeah, correct. It's just funny because I think you said it right earlier. We watch these movies sometimes for different reasons. The Dark Knight is so realistic and so doesn't feel superhero-y, and that's why some people love it and why I love it. But that doesn't mean that I also don't like a movie to be superhero-y at times. There right. are times when I just want to see the last scene of Endgame. Okay? Right. So sue me. Right. I want to see that. they're different. It's hard to compare those because this doesn't feel that super, if you will.
Well, and again, I feel like that's one of the things that I find fascinating and so painful about this trilogy in some ways is that, like, you have Infinity War, but then you have Thanos kind of get his comeuppance and you have that total, like, satisfying resolution that is the end of Endgame. Even though you do have a very satisfying conclusion to this trilogy, you never, like, the Joker never gets what's coming to him. Ultimately, right? Like, what he's done kind of hangs in the air. And he, at least personally, we don't ever really, it's not like we have this super satisfying moment of Batman just, like, taking out Joker with this, like, epic punch or something, right? Like, it's just yeah. like he kind of I don't know. I like that it's a little bit like if you know, Thanos just, like, after Infinity War, like, they never caught him again, right? Like, I don't know. I think that that's such a unique thing to do, whether or not that was intentional or just a product of the real-life circumstances there.
You won't kill me out of some misplaced sense of self-righteousness, and I don't want to kill you because you're just too much fun.
Gosh.
Oh, at the very end. Okay. Lastly, just a couple scenes I have to point out because people will get on my case if I don't, how good these scenes are, and then we'll just move on. The dialogue from the Joker in general is so good all the time. The scene that we talked about in the back of the kitchen is so fun with the pencil disappear and right. the talking head of Lau and the Batman. He's changed things. What happened? Your balls fall off? It's amazing. How about when one of the best scenes of all time is when the Joker takes over the party and he grabs Rachel and the camera's spinning and the music's going,
yeah.
He's got the knife to her throat. Or to her mouth, and he's telling a different story each time, kind of depicting that he's a little bit crazy and he's a liar.
Yep.
It's just so good. It's
By the
so
way,
good.
The camera work in general in this movie is incredible to me and so unique.
We talked a little bit about the intro scene, how fun the bank robbery scene yeah. is, and just shows a little bit how maniacal he is that, you know, he's told each individual worker that he can kill the previous worker, basically, right. until there's nobody left, until it's him. I said, yeah, so that scene's fun. There's just an incredible amount of dialogue that, like I said, I can't take my eyes off the Joker whenever he's talking. I just can't. How about when he burns the pile of money? All you care about in this town is money. You know, that's unbelievable. I'm going to give him a better class of criminal. All of it is so good.
Well, it's like, yeah.
I want to end with this, Robbie. Yeah. I want to ask you this. Do you think this has got to be a top three most famous villain of all time, right? I made a list. Sure, I think it's either Joker, Thanos, or Darth Vader. I'd be curious to see what our audience thinks is, like, the most notable villain of all time. Like, right. if you went to a small town in Africa, would they know Joker, Thanos, or Darth Vader? It's just interesting. That's how legendary of a right. character and this performance is.
Which we'll have to give time to Thanos for. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great point.
Thanos, maybe not as much because it's as on the level acting-wise, although I do think it's unbelievable, but more just because those movies were so big that now everybody knows who Thanos is. I mean, Thanos has worked into popular culture all the time,
right,
and sports references all the time. And that was Vader for a long time, too.
Right.
But this performance of the Joker, I feel like everybody knows Batman fights the Joker, right?
Right, which, by the way, to Kevin Feige and Josh Brolin's credit, like, the Joker, while this performance, I think, is
yes,
for sure on a level
say.
Of its own, like, Joker is one of the most famous comic book characters, period.
We already knew him before this.
Right.
Thanos was not, like, notable to a random person in New York City before this.
Right.
And now he is.
And
so
I think
that's a credit almost strictly to those two guys. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, which is really interesting because I think a few years ago, if you were talking Marvel villains, people would maybe know, like, Green Goblin and, like, Doctor Doom and some of these guys. But, like, I don't think anyone would have pulled out Thanos. Like, casual, you know, like, people like, coming from a position like you. You're right, though. I do think it's hard because Heath Ledger's performance is so incredible in this. Like, the writing in this whole film to me, and I mean this as a huge compliment, is almost like Aaron Sorkin-like, where it's like, it's really quick, but it's just like so thoughtful. I mean, and
so
some of these
deep,
lines are so memorable, like the famous one being, you know, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Oh.
Like, what a line and what a way to encapsulate some of the most poignant parts of this whole film. But even as I say that, I mean, like, the writing is great. The performances elevate the writing nowhere more clearly than with Ledger's. Because, I mean, I listened to it, and it's interesting to see kind of what was on the page and the way that he changes it with his little, like, lip-smacking thing that he does.
Yes. You can, by the way, Google some of these famous scenes with the script open at the same time.
Oh.
Yes, you can watch them. It's really
no
cool. So you can see the script, like, on the side while you're watching the screen and how it's a little different and how they described it. It's cool.
Keep going. That is really interesting. But, yeah, I mean, obviously, we could talk forever just about Heath Ledger's performance. But, like, the way that Eckhart plays Harvey Dent, I think, is also talking about kind of taking a character that could be one way and really making it memorable. Like, he does a great job of being so much the hero, right? Like, the guy that, like, he's kind of dashing and he's got this, like, debonair thing. But then again, like, the scenes with him and Rachel, you kind of see him be not just vulnerable, but almost like at the party, you know, where she talks about him being scared stiff by the trust fund brigade, where it's like you really do, like, root for him and don't see him as this, like I think what's so fascinating about the character as it's written and the way that Eckhart plays Harvey Dent is that you get moments of that kind of aggression you were talking about, like, obviously most clearly in the interrogation scene with him that Batman stops. But you do really see this guy that, like, is the White Knight, right? Like,
yeah, he's the hope for Gotham.
Like,
and that's why Batman, he's believable enough that Batman would want to retire,
right,
so that he can, like, pass the mantle on to somebody else.
But what I also love ultimately is that, and part of this is why those, like, little moments of aggression that you see there are so important. And
yes,
mind you, Harvey Dent,
he's corruptible.
He is. I mean, yeah. And it's not like, what I think is so, so cool here is that in some superhero sci-fi type movies, right, like, you might argue that he was somehow, like, corrupted in some kind of magical way, like, even like a Star Wars sense, like, the dark side of the Force seduced him or something. But it's just this, like Joker didn't like trick him or anything. Like, you can't be tricked into, like, giving in to corruption like that. Ultimately, like, that's like your own kind of moral progression in one direction or the other. And so it's this thing that, like, it is still the same guy. Like, even, and I guess what I'm saying is, like, it's not that he, like, falls into a vat of acid or whatever and comes out and, like, now he's, like, crazy and half of his face is messed up. Like, even though he looks so physically different, it's still just like this guy who's been hurt and wounded so much that like now he's totally broken.
No doubt. We need to say a lot of the performances are amazing in this movie. We spent so much time with the Joker that we overshadowed Aaron Eckhart's performance here. By the way, to tie in what I said earlier, the other two people that were auditioning for this role, Matt Damon.
Huh.
And you're going to love this, Mark Ruffalo.
Wow.
Can you imagine had Mark Ruffalo got this role? I don't think it would have worked for him because he's a little too like cerebral. Like,
yeah,
I don't think it's as like dashing, like all the things you said about Eckhart. I don't see Ruffalo having that as much, but just think about how much stuff could have changed.
Wow.
That would have been weird.
Well, you know? And Damon. I mean, I feel like just the look of Harvey Dent here is pretty important.
Yeah, no doubt. Also, I love having Michael Caine in Nolan movies. I love it. It's fun to see Morgan Freeman being a sidekick. He's got some funny lines, and there's some good moments there. Gary Oldman playing Commissioner Gordon is unbelievable. I think it's an amazing Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah.
And how he comes, like, this, the performances in general are awesome. By the way, Gary Oldman's underrated. He's done some crazy stuff.
Right.
It's really well done from that aspect too. And that's how I think we should wrap it up. I just felt bad that it's overshadowed a little bit.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, it's my favorite Batman ever. I love Christian Bale's take on Batman.
Yeah.
I really do like Batman, and I love Christian Bale as an actor so much. So it's just amazing. We just went that long of a podcast without really talking about Christian Bale, the main character of the movie.
Right.
And he's amazing.
Which I think, yeah.
But that tells you a little bit about the Joker. And Heath Ledger.
And again, I think, I don't think anyone really has a bad thing to say about Bale. I think what's just, you know, what happens is that people do talk so much about Ledger, it almost becomes this like background thing. But you're right. I mean, in my mind, not that his performance in this movie is in any way bad, but I do think that Batman Begins and Dark Knight Rises kind of highlight his take on the character a bit more and kind of give him some more interesting places to go. Because I think in a lot of ways, The Dark Knight is him reacting to what the Joker is doing, whereas the other two
for
films
for sure,
in the
but I do
are,
get to love
more.
Seeing him like sad and like defeated
right.
and how he plays that. I love that scene after Rachel dies.
I love the way they lean into his Bruce Wayne character being so different from Batman, like him really playing up the kind of jerk, the like way overconfident, egotistical thing. Like, which I love because it's like you don't, it's like
walking in with two girls on his arm
right.
to every party, taking a helicopter there, like doesn't have to do that.
Like
stuff.
The absconding with the entire Russian ballet. Moscow ballet.
Yeah,
it's like,
ridiculous. Yeah.
It is interesting. I think maybe for me, I mean, we could talk through a lot of this, and I still feel like there are books and countless think pieces written on like the questions this movie poses in terms of like the order and chaos, right? And like, is what Batman and Gordon decided to do at the end actually like, was that the right call? And I feel like The Dark Knight offers some really interesting perspectives on that of like, if you give people the truth that you think they need, is that ultimately going to work? Like, even if you have the best of intentions,
right.
if it's not the truth, like, I think there's a line in The Dark Knight Rises that I love where Gordon's like, maybe, you know, we've spent so long trying to bury the truth. Maybe it's time we just let it have its day.
You just gave me chills. You just literally gave me chills. It's such a good line. First of all, I love the line of, you know, the twist on it's the hero we need, not the one we deserve, but
right.
then the hero we deserve, not the one we need. I love that twist. Love it. But you're absolutely right that they ultimately, I think, make the wrong decision. That the easier decision is to keep lying because you don't want criminals to be released.
Right.
But I don't think that if they knew who Harvey Dent was, it would ultimately undo everything he did just because he snapped at the end of his life.
Right.
They ultimately make that wrong call. And that's when I love Robin in The Dark Knight Rises saying, you know, calling out Commissioner Gordon. And that's when he freaks out. He's like, we dipped our hands into the filth of, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Until you've done that, you don't know. Like, but he went through it all too. But he's kind of saying, yeah, they did make the wrong call a little bit there, I think. A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's... But
and
it's,
I love the beauty of that, though.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's okay that they can make mistakes to me.
It's such a paradox, and it's so, like, there are just so many things at play in this movie that I mean, I think we could do 3 or 4 hour-long podcasts on this, because it's like, even
I know,
even what you're talking about know. with should Batman have killed the Joker? I think in some ways, had Batman crossed that line, you could imagine, even if he doesn't go all the way to the Joker, like, isn't that kind of who Harvey Dent is? Like, Harvey Dent's willingness to, like, he's fighting for good, so he really thinks that as long as what he's doing is right and quote-unquote fair, that really anything is permissible. And we see that even before the Two-Face development, where, like, you see him getting so intense with this guy that he's interrogating and kind of losing his cool in a way that you rarely see Batman do. I just think that it's like you have a spectrum of...
You could also tie that into Civil War and like the Accords, that what happens if you have these people of great power and they just decide that this end justifies the means or whatever, and right. We don't agree with that. It's like, you know what I mean?
Oh, no, totally. Yeah, it's... Oh, man. Well, and again, maybe for me to end this, because I can just keep talking about the complexities.
Yeah, I was going to say to everyone out there, this is why I love Robbie and I love his podcast. Both of us called each other to start this podcast, and we said, I don't have remaining notes for this. It's a really good movie. I don't know what we're going to say, so we'll just go. And here we are, saying, I could probably do 5 episodes right. on this trilogy.
I think maybe to end this, it is really fascinating to look at what this movie is, like you said, as compared to what Iron Man is, and just to see how, like, in some ways those characters are even so similar, right? I mean, like, on paper, not necessarily the way that they're performed or written in these particular films, but I mean, like, the billionaire who just builds all of his own gear and doesn't really have any superpowers other than just being like really rich, and in Tony's case really smart, but it's like,
and rich,
right? I just think it is really fascinating to see that both of these films came out in 2008, both in some ways deal with similar issues of kind of personal responsibility, both take on...
And they're similar character types-ish.
Yep. They both kind of take on like a really kind of the idea of terrorism in some ways. But I just think, like, to go all the way back to how you began this, these movies definitely have some, like, they have some similar DNA there. Obviously could not be further apart in tone.
Right.
But interesting.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's fascinating to see what trajectories they sent the universes off on.
Right.
You know? Yeah. You know, I don't know that we would say this about every single matchup we posted, but I would strongly recommend, if you haven't seen these movies in a while, go watch the Dark Knight trilogy, especially while we're waiting for new Marvel content.
Yeah.
Go watch Spider-Verse, because I think you'll enjoy that. But also, I think this Dark Knight trilogy ages really well, and especially this movie. I mean, it's literally the 4th greatest movie of all time, according to people, and I actually agree with that. It's unbelievable. I really recommend you watching it.
Yeah, and I do think, as much as we said that this movie stands on its own, and it does, although I should say one thing that I forgot to mention earlier that always bothers me a bit, is that I hate that we had to change actors between Batman Begins
yep.
and The Dark Knight when it comes to Rachel Dawes.
Rachel, yep.
Come on, Tom Cruise. You know the story there, right?
Yeah.
He like wouldn't let Katie Holmes be in any roles there for a second, and so he robbed us of the continuity. Although I actually think Maggie Gyllenhaal really steps it up anyway, so maybe it was for the
is
best.
Is that like confirmed?
That is the legend, at least, like,
okay.
Is that he was at that point exerting a lot of control over Katie Holmes. By the way, I love Tom Cruise as an actor. I know that as a person, he's a complicated fellow, but,
I went to a restaurant with a friend of mine in New York, and it was one of these really small places, fancy, where you sit really close to someone else. And the person sitting behind me almost back to back touching was Katie Holmes.
No way.
One time in my life. Yeah, for real. So, fun fact. So, I also wish she was in this movie.
Yeah, I have read that it was, like, not Christopher Nolan's call. He did want Katie Holmes to return. And it was from her end of things that she didn't. And it would seem to be a strange call, given that the first one did really well and that it was kind of amping up into a trilogy. But anyway, we just talked about that. Again, something that we talked about with Iron Man.
Guys, I was trying to wrap this up. We can talk about this. Yeah, with Iron Man. It's true.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Rhodey. Is that what you're going to say? Rhodey.
Yeah,
Rhodey changes. Okay.
No.
This is going to go on for seven hours.
I know. All I was going to say is even that was a tangent from the larger point I was trying to make, which was I do think The Dark Knight is a movie that you can just watch on its own, and it stands up incredibly. However, I think that the trilogy as like a three-part narrative is incredible as well. And to your point, like, I think that if folks are looking for kind of another great rewatch experience, I think this is for sure up there with like Lord of the Rings as just one of the great epics of cinematic history.
No doubt. And I, just in case I never get a chance to review another Christopher Nolan movie, I actually would recommend you rewatching some of his films with a fresh mindset, like I'm saying. If you were a little bit confused before, I mean, go watch The Dark Knight, watch Memento, watch Inception, watch Interstellar, watch Inception and tell me it's not one of the greatest movies ever made, please.
Man.
I would, if like, be educated, pay attention, really dive in, and you'll love it. You'll love this movie. Gosh, Robbie, we could go on forever. I don't know what to say. I think what we need to do is, listeners at home, watch this movie and you write us. And that will maybe stir on some more topics for us to talk about later in some other facet, because we got to stop this here or we'll go on forever. But we want to hear what you think.
Yep.
We want to hear what you think about the villain. What about Ledger's performance? What about Bale? Did you love this movie as much as we did? Like, let us know. You can message us on our website, theffwpodcast.com, or anywhere on social media at theffwpodcast. And seriously, more than ever before, we'd actually really appreciate that for this film, because there's just so much we probably even missed. I mean, we went forever. We probably missed a ton of it.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about it. As always, if you can, please subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a review. It really helps. I think we're at 99 reviews.
No
so
way.
If you can give us 100, that would be great. So if someone's out there listening, you haven't done it, please do it. We would really appreciate that. We need to do a What's New in the MCU episode, but as I am standing here today, I think WandaVision and Falcon and the Winter Soldier are getting pushed back a little bit, which sucks because Robbie and I are not going to be able to talk about it soon, but hopefully it's not getting pushed back that much. And in the meantime, maybe, you know, lemons into lemonade, we can come up with more episodes like this one, Robbie, to buy some time as we're waiting for that content. But as I posted on Instagram the other day, I'm missing the MCU,
MCU
badly right now.
I'm really ready for it. I've been going back and embarking on all sorts of mini rewatches within the MCU. I've recently just been watching through all the Avengers movies. I'm running out of stuff here. But yeah, I mean, I will second that. If anyone just has any questions about this stuff, or if you have things you would love to see us talk through, review, I've talked about that like on the comic side of things. If anyone has any Kyle talks questions, I know that would be fun
as well.
So please feel free to hit us up there. We love interacting with you guys, and we love kind of sharing this stuff with you.
No doubt. So listen, share with your friends, leave us a review, subscribe to us, and we would love you for doing all of that. We've enjoyed talking about The Dark Knight with you guys, and we'll see you next time on Friends from Work.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.